You're listening to a Day1.fm show.
What I really wanted to do was entertain the world and see how far I could go. I wanted to be where my heroes were. That was on television in the UK, through Europe, and perhaps even America if I was lucky enough. The thing I wanted to take with me was New Zealand. So I was always going to be this. I was always going to use this accent, and I was always going to be proud to be a New Zealander.
We still work in New Zealand. We still have a home in New Zealand. I work for a New Zealand agency, Karen K Management, and that is all about not the brain drain, but Rhys and I going, okay, we have something to offer at home. How can we help you with the knowledge that we've gathered living overseas for the last 23 years? We still have our base at home. Like, Rhys will still jump at any opportunity to do a movie at home.
Yeah, I'll go home anytime. I mean, I love home. It's just not enough on the table there. And there never has been.
Welcome back to Diaspora.nz, where we're on a mission to seek out and profile the hidden gems, the best founders, operators, researchers, and emerging leaders of the great Kiwi expat community. Today, we have something a little bit different. We're in Los Angeles. We're talking to comedian Rhys Darby and his wife and manager, Rosie Carnahan Darby. Rhys, perhaps best known for his key role in the rise and the popularity of Flight of the Conchords, has built an incredible career that spans stand-up, television, film, voice acting. He wrote a children's book. He's a human sound effects machine with a killer robot impression. Rosie's been right there alongside him the whole way, managing comedy clubs, booking for venues from London to Edinburgh, and now managing a busy client list in LA. We talk about their entwined journeys over 25 years in the global comedy industry, dating back to Rhys's Dad's Army-inspired entry into the New Zealand Army. We talk about the business of comedy, how they approach new opportunities, how they structure and finance their ventures, and what the future holds, going direct to audience via Substack. We talk about tall poppy syndrome in New Zealand and imposter syndrome in the US, whether New Zealand's egalitarian culture, unique and enriching in so many ways, could actually be holding back our highest achievers and driving many of them offshore. We talk about AI and the entertainment industry. For all the hype and excitement we feel in tech, there's a lot of anxiety on the other side of the table, uncertain futures for artists, back of house and production, extras, and the entire industry that exists around it. Finally, we talk about raising a family in LA versus New Zealand, finding balance and getting the best of both cultures. Rhys has been a personal favorite of mine for so long. This was just a lot of fun, a real privilege to record. We're going to go get stuck in very shortly, but I want to drop one quick shout out. The Sunrise Festival is coming up soon at Blackbird. We like to say this is our love letter to startups. It's a one-day festival that brings together 500 tech founders, operators, policy people, and ecosystem supporters to be inspired, challenged, entertained. The second speaker announcement is actually coming out Monday, the 30th of September. I can't tease it too much yet, but while we're on the topic of culture and international business, there is one in there that I'm particularly excited for, another LA-based expat coming back. Sunrise is on November 26th. It's in Wellington. Tickets are half gone, won't be around for long, so if you've been looking for an excuse to get back to Wellington, this is it. Head over to thesunrise.live for more info and tickets, and we'll drop a link in the show notes as well. That's thesunrise.live for tickets. Thanks so much. Looking forward to this one. Let's get over and talk to Rhys and Rosie.
Okay, well, let's begin with a roll call, obviously. Rosie?
Present.
And David, is it?
Well, obviously, I'm head of interview, present.
You're interviewing me. Good. And obviously, I'm here. So that's Rhys, present. So let's continue. You can kick things off if you like, if you're hosting.
Now that we're all here. Rhys, many Kiwis, most Americans at this point too, have some sort of soundbite fixed in their mind from Rhys, from Flight of the Conchords. I'm a simple man. I can't get past the sound effects from the very early days.
That one?
My wife and I would relax after our exams and our university days with Rhys Darby sound effects. That's my one fanboy moment, I promise. But I'm particularly excited because you don't often get to hear some of the magic that happens behind the scenes, the business of show business. So really excited to have Rosie here as well. Rosie's been present throughout the Rhys Darby journey in many ways and broadly
always.
The New Zealand comedy and international comedy scene as well. So really excited to have both of you here.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm excited to be out of the house.
Yeah. And the house, for the listener context, we're sitting here in Los Angeles and you've had a long journey that's sort of led you here. And I'd love to trace some of that journey through. So we'll start with Rhys and we're going to build Rosie into this. So take us back. What were the inspirations? I know there's some Dad's Army. I know there's some Monty Python. What sort of got you started on this path?
Well, I guess from early childhood, comedy in general, just my mum, first and foremost, really, making the day a little lighter with fun. And she always had a great sense of humour. And, Yeah, we would watch stuff together after school, and it was usually BBC comedies. So you've mentioned Dad's Army. There was many others. Heidi High, Ain't Half Hot Mum, Fawlty Towers, obviously. Then you go into The Young Ones.
Red Dwarf. We just started watching that again.
Yes, true.
Would there be some of the influence?
Wait,
of these?
I've got to mention Blackadder.
Blackadder. There'll be some influence showing up in your work today, right? I mean, a lot of there's some classic British comedy genius.
Do you want to just read off Richard Curtis and Ben and Thingy's IMDb pages? Because they were writing on a lot of the stuff that has heavily influenced you now.
Yeah. And let's not forget, I you know, you're talking about my influences and you've mentioned Monty Python, and you go back even further to Spike Milligan. So when we were very young, Bad Jelly the Witch was a radio show. It was his story, and he told the story, and we got to hear it on Saturday morning on the radio in New Zealand numerous times. And that's probably, when I think about it, the initial seed, because it was so silly. He did so many funny voices, and the story is just uplifting and hilarious.
I read Bad Jelly the Witch to my, at the time, 5-year-old son recently, and it was an absolute hit. So I almost have a mental image of it right now.
You can get it on CD. We managed to find it on CD and used to like put it in the car for the kids when they were little. But I feel like it was on, I might be like misremembering the 70s, but I feel like it was on the national program every Saturday morning. They just replayed it every Saturday morning.
Yeah, I think so.
And in a beautiful kind of moment of kismet, flash forward 40 years, and what are you doing, Rhys?
I am the voice of Binkle Bonk.
No.
Bad Jelly the Witch, which is coming out soon.
Ah.
Yep.
Well,
made by Muck Putty, the New Zealand animation company.
Early in the episode to be running promotions, but that's one that I'm going to be attending, viewing repeatedly, probably while driving in the car.
No, don't do that.
It wasn't just Dad's Army, though. It was its close cousin, the New Zealand Army.
Yes, that's right. In fact, Dad's Army, look it up if you haven't heard of it. It's a classic British sitcom that went for many years. In fact, it started black and white, and then it went into colour, and that was a recent mum's favourite. That inspired me to join the actual army, because I just
<Of course>.
I just wanted to be part of a group that all wore the same clothing and had a laugh. Now, that's not really the army, but it was my
it's the New Zealand army.
Idea of the, yeah.
You know, you could have joined the local amateur dramatic society.
Well, I know, I know, but there's something about military order. They have their own law. You're under military law when you're a part of the military. So you're not a civilian. You're in your own society, and it's very strict. And there's a lot of discipline. There's a lot of self-discipline that's pushed into you. It makes you feel good about yourself. You're part of a team and you work hard, but also it can be very funny, because, you know, especially in a country like New Zealand, where we're not using our military for war much these days, what do you do? 90% of the time you're waiting for a war to happen, and it's not happening.
I bet if we can move that up from 90 to 100, we're even better, but you're right.
Yeah.
I've always wondered if creativity needs some kind of constraint to hang itself upon, and it feels
Definitely.
Like the environment of structure was what your creativity needed.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I saw within a very structured environment how creating chaos makes it funny, which is what I did in the army as well. I got into a lot of trouble for not being part of the team, really, in some ways. We'd be marching along, and I had a female friend, Brenda Cunningham. We were quite close in the army together, and we'd goof together. And so sometimes we'd be marching in a little squad, which is a group of soldiers, and we'd be in the middle and we'd be holding hands. And just so that the sergeant major could see that, someone would like, "Hey, you too," you know, and it's just like little things like that. Also, my other friend, Luke Andrews, he got into trouble a lot of times with me because our hair was slightly too long. We'd hide it underneath our beret. We'd turn up to work a little bit late because we're hungover and drunk from partying the night before. His uniform sometimes was on backwards. It was, you know, silly stuff like that. The good old days.
Luke's also, I asked Luke years ago why he joined the army, And he said, and I thought this was really interesting, he said, I wasn't ready to be an adult yet.
Yes.
So it gave me structure to be away from mum, but someone was still telling me how to make my bed and to get dressed and when to eat.
Mm.
It just felt too overwhelming to go out into the world at that point.
Yep.
And we've been talking about this a lot recently. Not that I want either of my kids to go into the army, but that structure is quite good for kids in their late teens as they learn to adult with the guardrails
There's
on.
There's something in the, I don't want to call it finishing school. That would be a crude like term for the army, but in the same function that the first couple of very unserious years at university will serve for people.
Absolutely.
The army is probably a healthier, more rigorous environment than what many people experience.
It sets you up better. I definitely, like, I still make the bed every day. I still fold all my clothing. I enjoy ironing my clothing and stuff like that.
You still march on parade and hold hands with Rosie?
if I could.
No.
Yeah.
But it is the thing, like, it's like, kids, if you want anything ironed, Dad has a gig this weekend. The ironing board's out. Because he does it to, like, relax and think about what he's doing. So whenever you need anything ironed, just pile it up and book him a gig.
I was going to ask later, but let's do it now. What is that one of the sort of the preparatory routines, or what do you do to get into the space or to practice your materials or to?
Well, when I was on tour, I used to actually turn up to the venue, set up the ironing board, and I would iron my character costume, because I would open my stand-up show with a character before my stand-up, Bill Napier, which was a ranger character. So I would enjoy ironing his stuff. And while I'm doing that, I'm thinking of comedy and I'm getting into the mode. Yeah, for sure.
We had it on your list of things you needed at every venue. It was an ironing board.
An ironing board.
All of these.
and some beers.
all of these fancy Hollywood celebrities rolling around with their big riders and Reese's up here with an ironing board and a beer.
That's
pretty
right.
Much, yeah.
I like to hear that.
That'll be the same next year too if I tour, which that is the plan.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about, so there was a transition out of the army, which may or may not have gone to plan, some encouragement perhaps from an officer tired of being made fun of through impression by that point.
No, he convinced me to leave, simply for my own good and the military's at the time. But he said, look, there are things for you to do outside of this institution. And he gave me a pamphlet for Canterbury University, which was just down the road. And it sort of made sense for me to leave one institution, and which I'd almost spoiled, and go and join another one that I could create more havoc in. So that was the university. Yeah, I wanted to keep my beret and stuff. And actually, I did keep some of my stuff. But it was just, leaving one group and joining another one. Now, Luke, my army buddy, went with me.
Right.
So I took one of my army guys and we ended up flatting together. And so it was kind of a smooth transition. And then straight into the university life, which was quite different. But going in as an adult student, even though I was like 21, I still felt like I was, 18, 17, except I could iron clothes and make my own bed.
You've got a leg up on the rest of them. And the good news is that unlike the army, perhaps the university campus had a few more acceptable social outlets, like, for example, the green room. And I want to switch the spotlight to Rosie for a second, because you have received some sounds like quite due credit for the work of the green room in the early years and the creation of the environment and the curation of the guests. And for some reason you let him on stage. So what was the story behind?
So I finished my BA honours in drama and was considering going back and doing masters. And I was sitting having lunch with the two PhD students in the drama program. And we're just kind of going, Christchurch sucks. There's nowhere you can perform. What's the point of doing these degrees when there's nothing you can do? So we decided to open a bar that had performance every night. At the time, Westpac used to have these $10,000 graduate loans and you could borrow it for whatever you wanted. And my parents were like, well, it's going to cost just as much for you to go and do your master's. You may as well fail in business and learn something do that. So I was there for, I opened it with the other two. We had it for about a year. I had it for about a year before I sold my share back to the others. But at that time I was, I did all the programming of the act. So I was 23 years old, very naive, but very ambitious. And we'd put in everything from weird mime to spoken word to music. And what happened was comedy was the most popular night. So these guys, Four Fingers Missing, would come and put on a comedy night and it would always sell out.
That was my comedy troupe, Four Fingers Missing. Mm-hmm. That was me and a few of the guys from university. So basically half the people in the university comedy club, the ones that wanted to do stand-up, basically.
Mm. So Chris Brain and...
Yeah.
I think who else?
And a few others.
And then...
A lot of the names just appear out of my hat at the moment.
And about the same time, the classic and all...
Although I'd be killed if I didn't say Guy Roberts.
Of course, yeah.
And his brother Jono.
Brilliant.
About the same time, the classic was opening in Auckland.
Yep.
And there was a bar in... Dunedin that was also doing comedy. So we were all kind of in contact and there started to be a little bit of movement with the Aucklanders coming down to Christchurch and Dunedin and having somewhere to perform. And so pretty soon after I sold my share, the classic called me and said, do you want to move to Auckland and run the club?
Mm.
And we were over Christchurch. So, yeah. And Reese kind of needed to do more than doing robot impressions in pubs at that point. And so we made the move to Auckland for me to run that club.
The quick anecdote about the Westpac loan to build a business, because even if you failed, you might learn something. I think that's incredible advice. I did something similar and I looked at it as, well, I might as well borrow from future David to do something now, because future David's going to bail me out of this.
I remember talking to Di Hemwood about it years ago, and his mum about this years ago, and he was doing Edinburgh, and this would have been the year, like 2002, 2003, when we were all there with Concords. And I said to him and his mum, I went, you have to look at Edinburgh as a trade show.
Mm.
You are going to lose money. Nobody makes money. It's a trade show. You're showing what you do at the hope that other festivals will book you. Like Reese got booked on Modern Family out of the showrunner coming to see his Edinburgh show years ago. Like, it's all about creating opportunity.
And you created your lion's share of the opportunity in those days between the comedy club and then it sounds like the transition through into Edinburgh. So tell us about, describe the Edinburgh Film Festival, or the environment, and you did some work with Edinburgh Film Festival for a while.
Fringe Festival. I had run the comedy club in Auckland. I'd worked for the comedy festival as the artist liaison and event manager. There was a logical move to then for him to perform in Edinburgh, and he and Jeremy Elwood and Terry Frisbee and Chris Brain got a slot at the Edinburgh Fringe as the Brat Pack, and I got a job at the Gilded Balloon, and we all headed over together. Mm. And there was actually a lot of us going around that time as well.
Safety in numbers.
Definitely. Because if nothing else, you could have each other as audience in your rooms.
Yeah, which we often did sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. And it's about the same time that you and Gilmore and Naked Salmons and everyone was going over there. Mm. And then I stayed over there. Because I realized that going back to New Zealand, I had limited learning opportunities.
Mm.
And for me, it was about learning how to run these big venues, learning what the industry looks like internationally, because that interests me. And the side effect was that Reese would benefit from that.
Mm.
Reese and others in New Zealand would benefit from my knowledge.
Also, I think we all fell in love with the big wide world when we went to Edinburgh, Scotland. Mm. So coming from an isolated little island, New Zealand, to then, you know, the biggest arts festival in the world was a real eye-opener. Mm. Now, I knew that, you know, it was going to be amazing, but none of us thought it was going to be that amazing. Mm. For me, it was like I'd found my home.
Mm.
And it was a magical Disneyland of art. And, you know, we were in our mid-20s, prime time for a human to be creative and want everything in the world. And it was all there for that month. And then when the festival finished, you know, the place got quite miserable. but we continued to live there because it's a cool city.
Mm.
And we learnt from living there to work whatever jobs we could underneath the table to survive. And then, you know, take that next step of, do I go all the way back home? Or do I continue my dream of trying to make it in the world and go to London, get an agent and do stand up in the UK, which is the biggest and, you know, most illustrious place to do it in.
Also the home of a lot of your comedic inspiration.
Exactly.
So
yeah,
I wanted to be sort of a resonance in the market.
Yes.
It's also one of the few places on earth where you can do multiple gigs every night, every day of the week. And so you just inherently become a better comedian.
Mm, more
it's changed a little bit now, 20 years later, but it still is the place where you can, you know.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. If you were, as I'm sure you do, you speak to a comedian or someone that's just starting out their career. Is there an Edinburgh Fringe Festival? Is it the Edinburgh Fringe Festival or something else? What's the first step that they'll take?
Starting out?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to start out in your own home base and and your local area. You've got to make sure that, you know, people are laughing at you and you're on the right track. And whatever you think is funny is what you want to do, and do that. Mm. Don't try and be someone that you're not. Don't try and copy someone else. It's all right to be inspired, but it's, you know, comedy comes from the soul, and it's you that are making people laugh. And then once you've secured that kind of local bit of fame, which you do, you can't just like just go and land in Edinburgh. I think you've got to walk before you can run, and that's a big step.
This is a conversation I have with, I work for an agency. Mm-hmm. It's a conversation I have with comedians all the time, is that you have to figure out your own voice first. Mm. If you're on stage and you are holding the mic in a certain way because that's the way you've seen someone else do it, that's not your voice. You haven't figured out what your persona is. Your material has to be developed to a point where nobody else can do what you're doing, that your voice is so strong. And if you're thinking about going to Edinburgh or even the Canadian Fringe, your hour-long show has to be perfect. It has to follow, has to be like a film in the sense that it follows a story arc. So I encourage acts to really get to that point at home, because once you hit Edinburgh, it's tough. It's sink or swim. And if you're not at the international level yet, it's a waste of money and you're not going to be seen.
Yeah.
It's really interesting just calling some parallels. As you know, a lot of the guests I've had on this podcast have been more in the technology centered, in the business end of the technology industry. Now, the equivalents that you're talking about here would be founders who are just getting going with their idea, their business. And if they, you know, launch into the big league straight away, sometimes they can be over their head. You've got to really be able to keep up if you're going to barge straight into Silicon Valley and expect to compete with the big guns. Mm-hmm. And so in some cases, you've seen successes of people who will stay home, they'll build the product, they'll serve a customer, they'll get to a point, get some traction before they jump over. In other cases, there's actually a benefit of trial by fire. You could say leave while young, even if you aren't as polished as you need to be yet. The way to get polished is by getting exposure to the international excellence, to build mentors and relationships with people in those markets. Does that feel resonant?
Yes, but I would say that if you use the comedy analogy, if you have one genius joke, then you need to stay home and come up with more genius jokes. Right. You might get booked off that one genius joke, but if you have nothing else to back it up, then...
Sorry.
Anytime,
as
you
our
like.
Son says, one trick pony, Dad.
Yeah. But that pony is amazing.
I think it's at least a six trick pony. I mean, there's
yeah, I can do other sounds.
He does it to wind him up.
Should watch some props. Here.
Helicopter.
So you're in Europe, and then it sounds like the transition back to America was actually tied to one of your more notable appearances in the Flight of the Conchords, or early, I'd say, earliest notable appearances. There's been several since. And if I'm not mistaken, you'd met Brett and Jermaine in Edinburgh?
No. I knew them from New Zealand before then. Yeah, so they just happened to be...
You did all the university comedy stuff. You bumped into them, didn't you?
No.
Okay.
No, not during the university comedy competitions, which is a funny thing that happened at university, which I think hopefully still happens. But yeah, we kind of bonded in Edinburgh, basically, because they were doing their show, I was doing mine. This is back in 2003, I think it was.
And 2002 and 2003.
Their show was a resounding hit. Everyone went to it. It was on at about 10, 10:30. So after your 8 o'clock stand-up shows, those comics would go and find the Concords as well. It was always sold out. They were a phenomenon, and they asked me to play their band manager in a radio pilot for the BBC, and I said, yes, let's do it, and we did it. We had a real laugh. I did the roll call. Next thing you know, we've got a series on the BBC, and then the next step was they went to America, and everyone fell in love with them over there, which is here, which is where I am now. And the TV show happened, and then I got a phone call, hey, do you want to be part of this? And I was very surprised, but of course, yes. And that's how I broke America, by accepting.
By saying, yeah, sure. Well, yeah, I think they had done like Aspen Comedy Fest, which is where HBO find all their new talent. And so they'd been picked up by HBO and then done a special, and then HBO had put them together with James Bobin to develop a TV show.
Yeah, you, just really you like, can Google all this stuff.
Yeah, you can.
What you can't Google
is... Don't listen to my wife. I think some of those details are wrong.
If only we could have the video of the expression we just got from Rosie. That was fantastic. The eyes are rolling.
We're talking about quite a long period of time here as well. From 2002, when I was their venue manager in Edinburgh, and they were not sold out. That was all the comedians coming to their show every night.
Right, true.
To 2007, when we went to New York.
Spoiler leak there. They weren't sold out.
Sorry, guys.
It was all comics with their tags, performer passes.
Well, so what you can't Google is the why. Like, is it pure art, or is there a science to why it took off? Why did it resonate in America? That really was a breakout moment.
Mm-hmm.
The American sense of humor can be quite different to our British and descended from British sense of humor. So,
yeah.
what was the thing that really made Flight of the Conchords catch fire?
Well, there's multiple things. Like anything that's creative and anything that's beautiful and artistic, you know, there's no direct answer as to why it works. It just resonates with humans in some way.
Mm.
And I think the other parts of it are that people do resonate to fish out of water, and people who have the... what's the thing where you feel like you're out of your depth?
Imposter syndrome?
Imposter syndrome. Yes, I've heard of this. I've never had it myself.
No.
But
yes, you have, and I can tell stories about that.
Says so, chief therapist over here.
Yeah. There's a whole thing that people can relate to, which is not just imposter syndrome, but people who are in jobs who don't really know what they're doing in their jobs, and they're just trying to get through their day.
Mm. Fake it till you make it.
Look at Murray Hewitt.
It's the Office formula. There's a genre of comedy.
Exactly.
Awkward comedy
awkward
as well.
Comedy.
And, you know, we were doing that. This was kind of, you know, around about the same time as The Office, maybe even before. We were certainly doing the radio show before then, and there was inspiration from a Christopher Guest comedy for The Conchords and I, which is, you know, Spinal Tap, that kind of thing, which is guys who are, you know, they've got some talent, they've got a band, they can do something, but they have no idea what else to do. And musicians in general are like that. Mm. Artists are like that. I'm like that. I've got this crazy talent, but without Rosie, I wouldn't know what to do with it, you know, and I know where I want to go, but I can't get there without help.
Mm.
And in this Murray Hewitt situation, it's the blind leading the blind. So that was made it even funnier, because Murray doesn't know what he's doing. And he's latched onto something that he thinks is cool, which is a band. He's a band manager. And so he's making it up as he goes along. The guys are making up their life as they go along, because they shouldn't even be in New York. You know, how their passports have been taken. Murray has them in his drawer, so they don't leave. And
they're his only friends.
Yeah, exactly. It's just that. And then also the magic of how the real Conchords, how good they really are. And so their music and the music videos that were in the show were just phenomenal. And then they put in the show, they cast good stand-ups as actors. And so that's you know, and that's why it was funny.
And it was a phenomenon. And in fact, while I was in America in 2007, I was riding the coattails for my New Zealand accent was immediately an icebreaker.
Oh,
because
nice.
They said, oh, are you from where the Flight of the Conchords are from? So thank you for your tee up on that one.
Oh, we've had friends get discounts on car rentals and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I know Reese. He's Murray. Can I have a discount?
Yes. You can endorse us and have it for free. I'm really curious. You kind of went out on top. There was two seasons. They were phenomenal. They were packed full of creative juice. And then there was speculation, is there going to be any more? And it seemed like a pretty hard no, that the boys were they, you know, tired,
they had enough.
Had enough.
And as you can see from the show, you know, we wrote it to, they wrote the finish of it. They, you know, we ended up back in New Zealand.
Right.
So that was the bittersweet end, especially for me, because I felt like I was really onto something here. You know, I was playing this great character. I was in a huge show in the US on HBO. And all of a sudden, you know, that's it. Right, let's head back. But luckily, you know, it opened the door to many other things. So even though I did run back to London, Rosie and I and our one child at the time, you know, a phone call came and next thing I'm on a plane. We're all on a plane, first class, back to LA to shoot Yes Man.
was wondering if Yes Man was the next step, was it?
So yeah,
working with
literally. Actually, you know what? That happened in between seasons.
Yeah.
Because right. I remember, yeah, so yeah. That was after the first season. I got that first big Jim Carrey movie. And by the way, Jim Carrey, you know, I idolized him from my teenage years as soon as I saw anything he did. And I dreamt one day of hoping, you know, my dream was to work with him.
Hopefully wave at him excitedly through a glass office door.
Yeah.
Well, that's the time you had imposter syndrome.
Well, okay. So I felt, I don't know about, I definitely felt like, but luckily he was so nice with me. Yeah. So he recognized my talent. He was a fan of the Concord show. And, you know, he saw something in me, gave that great quote on the radio about the Peter Sellers madness. And so we, you know, and he didn't have to be as nice as he was. He was just so wonderful with me. And they say never meet your heroes, but he's an example of how it went really well for me.
So you're glad you met one of these heroes.
Absolutely.
I think that you are the same with younger actors on set now. I hear you when you come home talk about how someone's quite new and that you just have to kind of adjust the way you perform to give them space.
I think there's a thing where young comics, if they're battling together to sort of get somewhere, there's a lot of rivalry. There always has been with comedy. And it probably is in other businesses as well. But in the arts, musicians probably, I'm not sure. But definitely with comics, they're trying to get these spots. They're trying to get on a show. They're trying to do this or trying to get their show to get a 5-star review other than others and sell out and then, you know, do tours. And there's a lot of competition. And I think when you look at me starting out as an actor, that was my first movie. And Jim at the point in his career, there was literally no threat. All he can do is just like really welcome me and get excited about something. And I reminded him of a younger him, of that kind of spirit of excitement of comedic whiz that you want to share with the world. So
it's a very positive sum mentality is the word I use. And it's something I've experienced a lot of in America. It's something I've experienced less of personally back in New Zealand. And I believe there's, you know, we can do this now, we'll do this later. There's a little bit of a thread running through of a tall poppy syndrome, which to me is a zero sum mentality of, well, there's only space for so many winners, so we're gonna have to divide the pie and make sure that no one's getting too much of the pie. Whereas in America, it's more like, well, there's lots of space for everybody to be winners, so let's grow the pie together.
I think it's it's a slightly different thing. New Zealand is quite a socialist country where everybody deserves education, everybody deserves healthcare, everybody deserves housing and to be fed and everything. I deserve as much as you. So when somebody excels and puts their head up, then why do you deserve it more than I do? I should also be allowed to have that. So it's a kind of is rooted in a little bit of like our quality kind of sometimes keeps us all at the same level.
Yep.
But it's okay for some people to do better and lead the way into a new way of doing things or earn more money or go, hey guys, we could make this movie or we could do this. Come along with me. Because that's the key that they do over here is they climb up on that ladder and they go, oh, here, do you want a hand up? Come and join me.
Yeah.
And that's what we need to do more of.
Yes. I'm glad you went straight for the red meat here because with the socialist comment, I think you're right. Like to me, it's less of a raise the floor for people to stand on. It's sometimes it can be a cap, lower the ceiling almost to make sure that people have the similar experience, which is a reason that a lot of people do leave.
Yeah.
It is a thing that I think we have to tackle together. So it's interesting to hear it really is across industries and professions and all sorts of things.
And even the Kiwis we know over here who are excelling, we all do hang out or we do know each other. You look at someone like Sean Marks, who's doing an amazing job as the general manager of the Brooklyn Nets. And it's really nice to see him, you know, leading the field. It makes you proud as a Kiwi going, more people can do that.
So I have a saying which I usually include in a teaser for the show. You can't be what you can't see. And one of the problems is that probably most people growing up in New Zealand don't see a lot of Sean. They see a lot of Reese, but not this part of Reese. They see, a lot of our biggest successes around the world. They leave and they'll go be successful because they have to be focused to do it. They have to be really in the zone. And New Zealand says, well, that's the brain drain. They left us. abandon us.
Mm.
So part of what I'd love to do is actually bring and put shine a spotlight on some of these stories and say, well, no, it's possible to be like this.
Whatever perceived success I have is because I was the woman behind someone who's incredibly talented.
Or you could say he might have been successful because he had a woman behind her.
Maybe it's the whole Michelle and Barack Obama thing, yes. Isn't it? Yeah, Michelle Obama, you wish. But now I've lost what I was going to say is that
I'm incredibly talented. I heard that, but
you cherry pick what you hear all the time. I mean, we still work in New Zealand. We still have a home in New Zealand. I work for a New Zealand company. A New Zealand agency, Karen K Management. And that is all about not the brain drain, but Rhys and I going, okay, we have something to offer at home. How can we help you with the knowledge that we've gathered over the living overseas for the last 23 years? And still having, we still have our base at home. Like Rhys will still jump at any opportunity to do a movie at home, like, you know, mm-hmm. Uproar or.
Yeah, I'll go home anytime. I mean, I love home. It's just not enough on the table there.
Mm.
And there never has been. And there's been little bits of things that are offered. And, you know, back when we were doing stand-up, there was pulp comedy and there was a TV show for stand-ups to go on. And that was exciting for us. Mm. You know, in our world, that was the best thing to go on because you get to be on TV and you can get a bit of fame from that. And then you can probably, you know, sell tickets to your show and become a bit of a name. And then there was like 7 days, this show that you know, I think is still running. Mm-hmm. It's changed.
I think they're on their 17th season.
Yep. It's changed mm-hmm. its format a little bit over the years. Yep. But that was another, you know, vehicle for comics to get on.
Mm.
But there's nothing much else, you know, and we just don't have the infrastructure to sort of get together and give each other more and give each other more confidence through having successful stuff.
There is a few things. Like, I think what people like Pax Asadi are doing is really good, like with Raised by Refugees, his show. There's a few really intelligent, motivated comedians who are amazing writers and directors that are doing things.
Yep.
But we're a country of 5 million people with limited funds.
Mm. Yeah, it's a small place.
And so sometimes it's good for people like Rhys and I to go out and get our job experience overseas and bring that knowledge back. And I would optimistically hope we're cutting a couple of steps out of someone's process by going, hey, what about this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one thing I encourage people to think about is that it doesn't actually have to be that binary as you're there or you're not. In fact, you can go overseas for a year and go back, and you can go overseas for 5 years but still travel frequently. It's actually maybe expand what is New Zealand from a country in the South Pacific to a national identity that we can be proud of and feel.
Mm. When we left England, Rhys said we had no money. We sold all our belongings to get to here on New Zealand. I can't even remember. And Rhys said, have you still got that money hidden in the secret account? And I said, how do you know about my secret account? And he goes, you told me once. And I used to have enough money for us to fly one way to New Zealand,
right. Hidden
in an account with no cash card. So I'd have to go into the bank to get
case.
It.
Yep.
It was my just in case. Of course, we could always reach out to family.
Mm.
But there was a safety in taking massive risks if I knew I had the money to book a flight home for us.
Yeah, but getting back to that New Zealand mentality thing, and I think this is something that I'm proud of, is that, yes, there may be limited things you can do back home because the infrastructure is small, there's only a few of us, and there's not much money. You can go to Australia where it's slightly bigger and there's a pool there. But what I really wanted to do was entertain the world and see how far I could go. I wanted to be where my heroes were. And that was on television in the UK, through Europe, and perhaps even America if I was lucky enough. And the thing I wanted to take with me was New Zealand.
Mm.
So I was always going to be this. I was always going to use this accent, and I was always going to be proud to be a New Zealander, and that's what I've stuck to, and it's worked. Mm. And so I've helped to bring that New Zealand comedic mentality and our sense of optimism and funniness to the world.
I've had actors tell me that him doing his New Zealand accent on television changed their experience in auditions in LA, that they were going and casting directors would go, you know what, just use your natural accent. Let's hear what that sounds like.
Yeah.
So it kind of opened doors for people as well that
I've never considered that. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's good.
Tying together a couple of threads here, there's a show that I don't know if this was one of the first you'd sort of produced or took on a lot more of with Short Poppies. And mm-hmm. Short Poppies feels like it might have been named in response to Tall Poppies.
Yes.
And that's then maybe a step into the latter career where you've been doing a lot more producing, a lot more varied activities. Talk us through that story. And it's a fantastic show. Anyone hasn't watched
Thank
it.
Thank you. Yeah. That was an idea that I had for a while, me playing different characters. And it started off just recording audio versions of me as different characters being interviewed. And then I sparked up a friendship with David Ferrier, who is a great journalist from New Zealand. And so I thought, hang on, I could do something with him where he interviews me, long form interviews as different characters. And then what if I turn it into a show whereby he goes to a small town in New Zealand and finds people who are essentially short poppies, people who are not sticking out, which is most people, who are just going about their ordinary day. And we find that everyone has a unique thing about them that is weird and
extraordinary.
Yeah. And so then the idea sort of felt more rounded by working with some other people to help write. And then we created a show that ended up being a situation comedy where all the characters were linked. And I'm really proud of what we did there because it was a one-off. It was only going to be one series of expose on, I think, 8 characters. I got to play 2 women, one older based on my sort of, my mum, 100%. And then one who
she knew that, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Although I don't think she liked the show. and I've got 3 sisters. And so I was brought up by my mum. I've got 3 sisters. So I'm pretty good at feeling out how a woman might work in a little way. It's kind of her, the way they hold themselves and things like that. So to portray a female was something I wanted to do.
Do you remember Jermaine and I helping you find Mary's walk? We're in the park in Ponsonby, Greyland, and Jermaine was directing. And you were still walking, you weren't walking right. And so Jermaine and I were trying to get him to walk like an old lady.
Yeah.
Back and forth across this park.
Yeah. There was so many physical challenges to playing the females and making them look believable. Because it wasn't meant to be a guy in drag. These are women.
Yeah.
And I'm really proud of how I managed to sort of pull that off because they're really, really realistic. And the younger one was basically loosely based on my sister Linda. And then the blokes, different types of guys. We also got we gave roles to our friends.
We pretty much wrote roles for people that we thought were really funny. Like we'd be writing an episode and go, oh, you know what? Let's have like in the Rod episode where he's the mechanic. I was going, let's have a little helper for him. You know who'd be amazing? Hamish Parkinson. He's super funny. Let's write it it's his. Like, so we did that a lot. But also kind of going back a step with it is I saw that we only had a small window to make this happen I think we needed to be back over here. So, you know, Augusto and I reached out to New Zealand On Air and TVNZ and said, okay, is this something you want? Because we don't have the time. We have this window. If you want it, let's all make it happen. Otherwise, we may miss this window of making something that's quintessentially Kiwi.
Yeah, we were really proud of it. And then we got to put it on Netflix. So the rest of the world saw it for like 2 years as well.
Walk us through the business equation piece of this, because this was one of the first times that you'd spun up a project from the ground up.
Yeah.
You raised the financing for it. You obviously invest a lot of your own time and effort and recruiting in it. And then is that something like... My mind goes to, well, that's probably a business and you've got the rights of it sitting with Netflix. There's probably some income streams coming. Do you do that financial calculus on a project like that?
It depends on the project and how it's funded.
Yeah.
So New Zealand On Air is essentially a loan.
Most people haven't had the experience of running a project like this. How is a project like that funded?
So New Zealand On Air, in New Zealand, you apply to New Zealand On Air for funding. It's very different over here. You're essentially pitching to networks who will come up with the funds for you should they like what you do. You can also invest some of your own money to top things up, which we certainly did with Short Poppies to make things work in the vision that we wanted. Then you can also do pre-sales, which is essentially what Netflix was. It was they gave us a sum of money to license it for 2 years, but they don't have anything other than the license agreement.
Right.
And that's pretty much what we've done with all the specials as well. And the way I funded them has been very different. Essentially, I say to Michelle, who usually directs specials, I go, okay, I've sold this much in tickets. That's your budget.
Mm.
So we've sold out the Civic. That's X amount in ticket sales. You need to do it within that budget.
Wow.
So that we break even and we have something that we own. But this is just the way I do it. Other people will go out to networks and get funding for it or invest their own money and sell it later.
There's more of I understand there's more of a culture now of artists, of actors taking equity in projects instead of just cash up front and other sort of ways of incentivizing or aligning interests. Have you seen anything creative like this recently?
I think you can kind of do whatever you want, really, when it comes down to it. And it depends on whether you're talking about New Zealand or the US.
Yeah.
I mean, the US used to, it was famously when the streaming wars were happening, people were getting million-dollar checks thrown at them for their stand-up specials. But there was a very small number of people.
Mm. Yeah, the Netflix special was certainly is still a thing, and a lot of them were clearly very highly produced. What I love to see, and this is almost a transition to the way I found you for this particular episode was your Substack, the first thought I had was, is this the modern Netflix special? Is this the way that you build your direct relationship to build your sort of direct connection? What's going on here? What are you doing?
Well, I think Substack for me felt like a world. So it wasn't just like TikTok. It wasn't just, Instagram stories or X, formerly known as, better known as Twitter, which is just little bits and pieces. It encompassed all of that kind of stuff. Mm. So what it was sold to me as, I can do audio, I can do video, I can write, I can put whatever I want down, even my thoughts, my notes, and I can just get a whole bunch of subscribers to enter my world. And when I see fit or when I get the vibe, I can put anything out. And it was just positive. So, people, one of the worst things about X is that it just turned into this toxic,
it's a cesspit.
Yeah.
Whereas Substack, you're sort of presenting it, you go, this is my world. If you wanna look at it, sign up. If you don't.
Yeah.
And nobody's in there, it feels quite kind. No one's in there going, oh my God, I can't believe you said that word.
Yeah.
It feels like, how you've heard
it. Your response to that as well, just unsubscribe then.
Exactly.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, with X, it's people just yelling at each other. And taking things the wrong way, it's a gossip mill. It's kind of like from a celebrity standpoint, it was too much. There's so much influence on me from fans and expecting me to look and read and see so many things that mention me, and as I had to at one point, especially after like one of the seasons of the Our Flag Men's Death, I had to go to Costa Rica for a while just to throw my phone away. And so I didn't, it's kind of like we can become so self-obsessed, everyone now, because there's 5 minutes of fame for everyone on these social media things. How many likes can you get and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
So I wanted to, Substack for me, it's like I'll create a world, I'll do stuff. And instead of fans, only fans, it's only subscribers.
Yeah.
So basically, it's for people who positively want to actually enjoy what I create and then go about their day.
I think that they'd probably quite appreciate the description of OnlyFans, but not that stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
I think also it's about setting boundaries, is that in this modern age of social media, which didn't exist back when we first started out in entertainment, is it's created a lack of boundaries that people can yell back at you. And sometimes when you see that, it's really hurtful. And I'm like, would you say that to me in the street? No, you wouldn't.
Yeah.
You think that I have privilege and it's okay to say that to me, and I'm not okay with that. So again, we spent weeks looking at Substack, and I joined so I could get my head around it to help him, and felt like it was a curated thing where it wasn't going to be people taking a chance to sling some shit at us to make themselves feel better.
Yep.
Mm. Or taking advantage of your stuff to then use on their things to make them feel better about themselves amongst their group or whatever. It's, you know, the internet's a mess. The social media thing is such a mess.
It's sort of bifurcated into all of these different little niches.
And
it seems like you are running experiments across the rest of them. Like, I think I watched a video of you getting dressed up as a mermaid on TikTok last night. That was odd.
Yeah,
but all of this is going to be funneling into the subs. But it seems like you'll still run TikToks, you'll still run others, and you just you get to stop listening or stop reading the comments section. Is that right?
Yeah.
I mean, he hasn't read the comments in years. I don't respond to comments either. Yeah. You just can't. Our kids are either incredibly private on social media or block everybody.
Yeah,
because they've had to grow up with it. And Theo said to me the other day, he goes, "Don't tag me in anything because I get 100 friend requests when you tag me in things." I was like, okay, fair enough.
I'm sure you have found kindred spirits in Los Angeles. Here we are. There'll be lots of others in your situation, local friends, American friends, international friends who are raising kids here. I'm really curious about that experience. I'm raising a 6-year-old and a reasonably newborn baby of my own, and we're in New Zealand. We're going to be able to recreate a lot of the experience that I had growing up, and that's one of the reasons we moved back there, to be able to do that. And you are choosing to, you know, to do the same, but in Los Angeles, which is a very different environment.
To be fair, we do have a house in Matakana, though. And so the kids do get that Kiwi experience.
So you get to get back to, oh, that's great.
Yeah, they go and camp in the bush and they will go fishing and try to light fires and all the kind of shit that we used to do in the 70s.
Yeah.
What I would say is raising kids here in LA, particularly when a lot of their friends' parents are way more high profile than Reese is, it's good to have.
Wait, what? who? What do you mean? Yeah. Who?
You know, directors that are a bit more famous than you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Is that it's good to, for there to be no weirdness. Like, nobody cares what your parents do.
It's
whether you like that kid or not.
They're not sticking out here. We're not tall poppies here.
Mm.
It's just a different psychological vibe here in Los Angeles, you know, where everyone's kind of, it's spread out. Everyone's trying to make it. Everyone's trying to help each other to make it.
Mm.
And
I mean, he's working on a show right now with one of our son's best friends' dads, because they got to know each other because our kids are friends.
Yep.
And I think also that when you're around so many creative people, people don't go, "Oh, you're an actor. Oh, what have you been in? What I've seen you in? Do you make any money?" Which is the stuff that you get asked at home. Like,
Yeah.
It's not a shit fight here. It's enjoyable.
You know, coming up to you asking you to do a roll call and awful things like that.
I get the odd annoying thing, but you just you grin and bear it.
Yep.
And keep going.
I'm interested in the collaborative relationships. You've had some very strong ones. The Flight of the Conchords is one. You've done a lot of work with Taika Waititi. You've had others a lot. What do you look for in a creative partner? What makes the chemistry?
Like-minded spirit and optimistic viewpoint on creativity. Those are the strong things for me. And
not
optimistic
a dick as well.
Viewpoint on creativity is a hell of a line. Unpack it.
Yeah, so that means that making people laugh for happiness' sake, not bringing anyone down, not punching down.
It's very wholesome. I mean, your humor has always been family friendly.
Exactly.
Uplifting would be a word.
And that takes us back to, you know, Spike Milligan's work. You know, it's just be silly and enjoy being a human.
Mm.
And
be kind.
Yeah, be kind is another one as well.
Yep.
So people who are willing to do that.
Act with integrity.
Yes, and have integrity and be honest and also lift others up. And,
That's obviously a framework you'd use to choose roles as well as collaborators. How do you think about a role in a new movie versus a property that you own yourself, like a Substack? Are they things that you'd be able to trade off against each other, or was it just you?
I think either way, I look at it creatively as being able to be in control, do the best I can. One of the best things about acting is, you know, you get a few takes, and I'm often better on the seventh take. With stand-up, you get one shot at it, but you get many hours at home to go over it in your head. Mm. Yeah, I like all forms of performance creativity. So,
do you think the stand-up, though, plays into the film acting in the sense that if you did only have one take at the end of the day before everyone goes into overtime, you can do it because you're used to thinking on your feet?
Mm.
Oh, 100%. I mean, you know, there's the improv skills that, that come from years of being on stage because you've got to think on your feet. And I apply those to my acting as well. And I think that's important with comedy is if you've got a comedic brain, you should be able to use it rather than just do what's on the paper. You know, I think there's. So give us a few takes. Let's do what you want to do and then I'll show you what I want to do. And I guarantee it'll probably be a little bit funnier.
And then we haven't talked enough about me recently.
Yeah, let's do that.
And then with his team, we make sure that whatever environment he's going into is he's protected on all fronts, that we know what he needs to get off a plane and start working immediately. Mm. We know what type of person he wants to work with. We know how to protect him at the contract level. Yep. All that kind of, all the little the shit that he doesn't need to worry about, people like me and his massive team, we worry about it for him. So it's good having people that can dot your I's and cross your T's.
How did you learn those skills? Did you have mentors or did you have a learning curve up into the management of a high-profile artist?
I just made it up as I went along. Google is my friend.
Great.
No, actually, I would say Reese's manager, Tucker, he's taught me a lot. He started out as a manager around about the same time he signed Reese.
Mm.
So,
a little bit like Murray.
Yeah. And he and I talk almost every day and we can talk, through things and we talk, and he's been really valuable and just having those conversations with agents and managers and like other actors and other managers and go, do you think this seems right? Or how do you feel about the state of the business going like this? And then it's difficult then applying the US model to New Zealand because it's very different, but you do take those standards of what an actor needs to be protected and go, we should really have these protections here in New Zealand as well.
Mm. We heard a little bit before about Reese's advice for a young Reese getting going today. What's your advice for a young Rosie, somebody who aspires to be a producer, a manager, to follow in your footsteps? How do they get started? And there's a little bit of a theme here we haven't touched at all of the world's changing quite quickly and the way that content, the generative AI revolution is impacting Hollywood quite quickly, it seems. Probably not touching your world.
And this is where we will completely, I'm sure that we probably sit on different sides of the fence because with AI as creatives, we're like, get the hell out of here.
Wow.
Yeah. Because it will take away our jobs. How do you start out? I mean, my career has been shambolic based on what he was doing or what I felt like doing at the time. Like, started out in venue management and talent scouting. And then when he was on Concords, I was like, I'm going to be so bored if I can't get a job. Maybe I'll try producing. And I texted a friend. I went, how do you produce? And she goes, I don't know. Google it. So I literally did. How do you produce a live show? And then I just learned on the job and I'm good at asking questions. I think if someone goes, I want to be in talent management, the path here in the US is go and work for an agency, work your way up from assistant to manager. There are other paths though.
Could you not be like Tucker perhaps or spotting your own talent? Certainly if you are in the tech world and you want to become a venture capital investor, say the best way to get started is to go out and find promising young founders, see them before, or not young necessarily, but promising founders, you see them before anyone else has. You see something in there that no one else has seen and you make a bet on them. And if you do that often enough and you're right often enough, then you've earned the right to make it.
Absolutely. But you do need to be under an umbrella organization because no matter how talented someone is, a casting director is not going to take a cold call from someone that goes, oh my God, I found this guy. He's awesome.
Right, right. So that's where sort of the social capital is such a big piece. It's not just the financial capital that you swing around.
Yeah, and I would say also, I mean, I've done courses at UCLA in writing so that I could understand what we were reading and what we needed. I think where it's different from when I started out is you have to have a really good understanding of social media.
As long as you're not reading the comment section.
That's an understated quality though, being able to spot talent. And if you feel as though you're good at that and you can, emerging bands, emerging comics, artists in any way, if you feel as though that's something, a skill you have, then, you know, not many people have that.
And I do. I have it.
You have it. That's why you ended up doing it.
Yeah.
But it is a real skill.
I can see when someone's pretending.
Yeah. Exactly. It. So it's being able to read people, and it's being able to sort of like, you've got a knowledge of art in general, and which you do. You have a degree in honors, with honors in dramatic arts and stuff like that. And you can see where people have potential, and you know, that whole scouting thing is a really cool thing to get into, because that can lead you to where you want to be. And that's, I think that's, as you say, it's a difficult path to start on. But if you feel as though you've got those skills, they're worth investigating for sure.
And they're good. Like, to this day, I will email someone at a comedy festival, for instance, and go, hey, I have this guy. I 100% back him. You know me. I don't back him. I won't tell you someone's good. I won't bullshit you.
Yep.
And so having that integrity where people trust you is important as well. And then we haven't shoehorned our son's band into this conversation yet, but Great Big Cow. Listen to them on Spotify. But when we kind of thought he had something as a performer, and then when we saw him at the Whiskey and the Troubadour this summer, he and I were like, oh yeah, he gets performance. Wow. He gets it. He knows how to deliver to an audience. And it to be very, very, very authentic, his performance.
Chip off the old block.
That's waiting for the claim.
That's my son, Finn Darby. Great Big Cow. They're on Spotify.
Let's see it. I'm sure he'll feature in the Substack sometime as well.
Yeah.
What do you do? So you identify someone, you walk past them in the street busking, and you think they're the next Ed Sheeran. What happens next?
So usually what will happen is they'll come to me. Sometimes an actor or a comic will come to me multiple times, and I'll think they need to grow a little, or our office will all look at people together as well. It's a little bit of like, do they have that raw talent? Are they bringing something unique that I've never seen before?
Yep.
And for me, can they do their business? Like, will they reply to an email? Mm. Will they pick up the phone? Will they
actually... Would he have replied to an email?
No. But he has me. Okay. Will they actually submit their auditions on time? Will they turn up on set on time? Because there is nothing worse than having someone who has talent but actually can't find their sides on the late to set.
Yep.
They've missed their makeup call, like whatever. You're like, you're not going to make it because nobody's going to want to work with you. Like, a set is a tightly oiled machine.
I would say most comics have made it with 90% drive and 10% talent.
Mm.
But if you've got 90% talent and only 10% drive, you're not going to make it.
No, you won't.
And there's so many out there that are funnier than the ones that are famous, but they're just sitting at home and they're frustrated.
So I'm just sitting here nodding along because, Rosie, you're basically a seed venture capitalist of the comedic sphere. I see the same thing all day long. A founder comes to you once and you say, I really need to see this built out. And another time and another time, and eventually maybe you'll write a check, which is a financial commitment. It's also a social capital commitment. It's a commitment to endorsing you to all of the latter stage investors, to all of the customers I might introduce you to all of the talented individuals that might want to join your company. And then there's sort of this step ladder as you go up of, well, it's the early stage people who are doing the talent spotting, and then there's the later stage. And I think there's a rough parallel in this industry for sort of you get signed by a big label, or in music, it might be a big record label. So I love to see that. And if anything, I hope that can just encourage more people to get on the pathway, to know that, you know, even if you get a no from Rosie the first time, you know, keep trying. And
some of you don't keep trying, they don't keep trying.
Yeah, it's 90% determination that really counts.
Yeah.
Also, I would say that Reese and I are doers. And so are our kids, actually. We don't spend a lot of time sitting around going, oh, my God, we could do this, and then turning on the TV. I mean, we do, but we tend to, if we think the idea is really good, we will run at it, we'll pitch it, we'll start writing it immediately. We will do it.
Mm.
At the moment, I think we have 10, like maybe 10 different projects on the go at different stages. 9 of them won't go, 1 of them will. We just have to keep on like running at the wall and finding the right people that see our vision in it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. We're just about coming on time, but there was one thread about 10 minutes ago I wanted to come back to, which was the AI one, because I feel like there is a strong opinion there waiting to be unearthed. Feels like it could be a positive or a negative. A positive could be you can use it as a sounding board for your comedic material. You could in some future world, you could probably be even licensing out your sort of your voice and actually earning in a more scalable way Perhaps with the voice acting component of it.
Possibly, but then...
The negatives outweigh the positives for you. So I want to hear...
So if you're talking about licensing out your voice, I mean, we just went through this with the SAG contract, is that you wouldn't have any control over what your voice is doing.
Right.
And does it make your voice less special if everybody can use it? Yeah, and yeah. Also, you're then not looking at the nuance of what a really, really good voice actor can do in the room, taking from the script and everything that's around him,
yep.
and delivering something that is unexpected.
Mm.
The minute we can make animations with all AI, then there's no career path for a voice actor.
Mm.
Yeah.
There's also...
It's crushing us, you know.
Yeah.
And we're in a phase at the moment where it's really, really awkward and worrying. And I don't know how long that's going to last. And, you know, when we get to this time next year, let's see where we're at.
Mm.
But it's pretty scary for artists and people and crews and anyone who works on the technical side of trying to make television. They are finding that
if you can do it all on your computer,
their jobs are going.
Mm.
If you can do it all on your computer, then what happens to the gaffers and the electricians mm-hmm. yeah. and everyone on set, the caterers, all the people that rely on those sets? I think also part of me feels okay about using AI to fill thousands of people in the screen. Having said that, I mean, it's been done with CGI for years.
Yeah.
Having said that, there's a huge industry here in the US where people are background actors and they get their SAG mm-hmm. card being mm-hmm. a background actor, which means they can get health insurance.
Right. Yeah.
So you take away all of that, you're actually collapsing the entire entertainment sector.
Right.
So while I understand that a lot of tech people find it very exciting,
yeah,
you can't suddenly change things because the entire, I mean, look what happened during COVID here. Mm. How many restaurants closed during the strikes here? We had COVID, then the strikes. All the restaurants closed because nobody was spending any money. We're not going out for burgers. We can't afford to. We don't know where our next job is. And so I kind of see AI as potentially having the same effect.
I see it as diminishing the importance of humans.
Mm.
And I work in the field of comedy, which shows how important humans are. Mm. We're important because we make each other laugh to get through our life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we diminish the capability of ourselves doing that for each other, then what are we here for? Mm. We're all just going to be looking at screens of robots doing stuff for us.
But they say mental health is dependent on human interaction. And if you look at what a film is storytelling and telling a story that you could resonate with you so you feel like you have a human reaction.
Mm.
There's something disingenuous about that if it was an AI yes. created actor. And so what would that do to mental health? You look at in New Zealand, we invest all this money in making sure that we see ourselves on screen. If that's AI, does that diminish, like we said, does that diminish our relationship with the story and the person on screen?
Yep.
But on the positive side, yes, you're right. I am writing a lot of AI material.
Great. And actually, if there was AI and voiceover, you wouldn't have to go to this ADR session shortly where you're probably just going to go,
I think you're right. It's a really good call out, and I'm really glad you've done that because I think a lot of the listeners to this podcast are going to be in the sort of the technology mm-hmm. mentality. So thank you. And I quite honestly don't have much in the way of optimism for the back end of the production. I think that there is going to be a lot of change. That is mm-hmm. the reality. And a lot of the sort of the second and third order implications of that are real. One little like spark of optimism I'd throw for you in particular is what I'd expect is basically the more the world moves into this AI space,
uh-huh.
the more humans going to value the experiences that, as you say, it's the things that you come together for. That it's like in COVID, we all were able to survive on Zoom, but it was after COVID that we actually realized how much we valued coming back together.
True.
Right.
So if you are somebody who can create a live experience,
mm-hmm.
it's actually those live experiences that become more and more valuable. In the same way that a touring artist, it's a musician, their content is basically commoditized, has been for years mm-hmm. on Napster, then Spotify, then the internet. That's why they're all touring. That's why Taylor yep. Swift does $1 billion tour.
She's an anomaly, though. You look at most jobbing comedians or musicians, they're not making that money. They're not making money off Spotify.
No.
They're making jack shit. And I know this because obviously I help my son's band with their admin and I see how little they're making compared to how many listens they've had. That used to be different back in the days where you were getting a record deal and they were selling those physical records.
Right.
So in a way, the audio streaming has kicked them in the nuts.
Yep.
And it's very, you're also, we see this with comedians at the moment, everybody's touring. So who are you spending your money on? You can't, nobody can afford to
go to all of them.
Go to all of them. So if the organizations, whether it's a TV network or Netflix or whatever, were giving you money so that you can survive and create your stuff rather than you going, surviving on clicks and someone buying a ticket, it would be different, which is what it used to be like.
So I didn't mean to end this with such a strong plug for Substack, but I'm going to have to do it because one answer to the quandary that you've laid out is that everybody has a niche and they have to find that niche and really build into it and find their 1,000 true fans. And the Kevin Kelly framing, I think, was the 1,000 true fans are the people who really want to support you.
Yep.
Right.
And those 1,000 true fans can pay for the direct relationship that they can build with you. And so every comedian is out there building their Spotify, building their Substack and building their direct fan base relationship. So you are once again sort of carving a path ahead for others to follow. I'm excited to follow along, excited to subscribe and be a part of the community. And I'd encourage others to do the same. Any other final shout outs or where could people find you? Looking forward to Bad Jelly the Witch. What else should we be looking for?
I will definitely with Substack, I'll be letting everyone know everything that I've got coming up through that little world. And while some of those other social medias might fall off, because they have their heyday and then they either get banned or or you want them to get banned. I think as long as people are keeping positive and friendly and kind, then the world of Substack just feels like the right place to be putting my art out into.
Yep.
Other than that, live, like get out there and see live stuff. And I think,
do you have any upcoming dates in New Zealand or plans?
No, but I am going to do
but we haven't announced them.
Big show, hopefully soon. So the rest of this year will be me fluttering about and trying out material here in Los Angeles and other parts of America. So stay tuned and I'll see you on stage. Don't come up on stage though.
No.
I'll be on stage. I'll see you.
Pretend it's like a screen. Pretend it's like you can, he can see you. You can see him.
Yeah.
But you can't touch.
Yeah.
Look,
yeah.
Don't touch. Like it's like a museum.
It's definitely not an AI.
Well, let's see.
although, I could, if it was AI, I could make way more money off you just sending the AI robot versions out.
Franchising me out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that had been my plan with our youngest son, who's super funny. I was like, Junior Reese.
Yeah.
Brilliant. We'll call it a wrap. Thank you very much, both of you.
Thank you.
Cheers.
That's a wrap. Thanks for listening. As a quick reminder, make sure you hit subscribe in your favorite podcast player so you can keep getting stories like this landing your feed every Friday. Power you through those weekend chores. I want to give a quick shout out to the boys at Supermix who do all our editing. Zach and Xavier are Kiwi expats themselves. They're building a thriving business in the heart of New York City. A lot of respect. Not a sponsor, just a happy customer here. Also, for my day job, I'm an entrepreneur in residence and an investor at Blackbird Ventures. We're backing the best Kiwi founders wherever they are in the world. My personal sweet spot is pre-seed and seed. I like to say no check is too early, so drop me a line anytime. It's dbooth@blackbird.vc. We'll look forward to seeing you back next week.